Members, we will call this committee, the House Commerce Committee, to meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. Now that Representative Albright is here, we are going to start with his bill because it's my favorite, not because he's the only one here. Representative Albright, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1203 so that it is before the committee. And with that, Representative Albright, and to your testifier, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak to House File 1203. This is a fairly straightforward bill brought forward by the Minnesota Academy of Ophthalmology. Members, prescription eye drops are used to treat countless eye-related problems from young children to older adults. Many of us in the room certainly have from times ago utilized those for any number of maladies. However, eye drops are difficult to administer, no matter how old you are and what condition you might have. But the problem compounds itself in older adults who might be using them to treat, as an example, glaucoma, while also suffering from other physical ailments. As a result, on a 30-day prescription, an older adult with glaucoma might run out of eye drops, say at age or at day 25 in a 30-day prescription, and then be forced to go without eye drops for a five-day period of time because of denial by the insurance company until they reach day 30. This bill simply makes it so that the patient can get a refill on those prescription eye drops in the event they run out between day 21 and 30 on a 30-day prescription, or between day 75 and 90 on a 90-day prescription, so long as the original physician indicates a refill is needed. We have talked with health plans, and they are not opposed to this change. It does not provide for any additional refills beyond the original amount in the prescription. And by way of verification of this information, Mr. Chair and members, I do have with me a testifier today, Mary Lawrence, who is very capable of speaking to this and answer any questions you might have. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I am open to questions.
Dr. Lawrence, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Dr. Mary Lawrence, Chairman Hoppe, and other committee members. I come before you today to address one of the causes of blindness and what can be done to help prevent blindness in Minnesota. My name is Dr. Mary Lawrence. I'm a physician. I'm an ophthalmologist who has been licensed in Minnesota for 20 years. I've practiced at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. I've been a professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School, where I serve as director of the Vision Rehabilitation Center and a member of the Glaucoma Service, and I've been on the staff at Phillips Eye Institute in Minneapolis. From 2010 to 2015, I served as the lead civilian eye surgeon at the Department of Defense, Department of Veterans Affairs, Vision Center of Excellence in Washington, D.C., and there we coordinated the care of our wounded warriors coming in from Iraq and Afghanistan in Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. So on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Ophthalmology, 300 eye surgeons across our state, we thank you for the opportunity to bring forward this legislation to help Minnesota patients maintain access to prescription topical eye medications for the preservation of their vision. First, please allow me to expound on the problem that Representative Albright indicated. In Minnesota, we have thousands of patients who are treated with topical eye medications every year, from small children to elders. In our practice as ophthalmologists, glaucoma is one of the most common diseases we see, and untreated, it leads to blindness. In older adults, glaucoma is most often treated with a long-term course of prescription medication as topical eye drops, a little bottle like this. Although many of our patients take their eye drops regularly and on schedule, ophthalmology is unique in that compliant patients have difficulty administering eye drops correctly. Unlike prescriptions for pills, eye drops are difficult to use, and we have found that almost half of the patients who require eye drop treatment regularly administer more than one eye drop at a time. And if any of you have ever had to take eye drops, sometimes you drop two in instead of one, or one goes on your cheek. This number is greater, it's almost 80% actually, with patients who have poor vision from glaucoma, cataracts, and retinal disease. The difficulty in administering eye drops in older adults is often compounded by other ailments like arthritis, Parkinson's disease, and tremors. A significant problem for many of these older adults is encountered when they get to, say, day 25, I'll use the same day Representative Albright did, of a 30-day prescription for their glaucoma treatment, and they no longer have any more medication in their bottle. Very often when these patients attempt to get a refill, their prescription is denied because they have not reached the end of the 30-day period. And that leaves them suffering for 5 days without any treatment. Glaucoma patients in particular who are untreated even for a relatively short period of time, like 5 or 6 days, run the risk of worsening vision loss and an increased likelihood of surgical intervention for their disease, which carries greater risks and increases our costs significantly. This legislation will alleviate a gap in treatment by allowing patients who run out of topical eye medication before their 30 or 90-day renewal time to fill the prescriptions should they run out after day 21 or day 75 without the risk of denial by their health plan. This is consistent with Medicare guidelines and would not increase the total number of refills that an individual could get on any given prescription. It will simply help to ensure that these patients, most often our elders in our state, will be able to maintain access to the proper medications for treatment without running the risk of further vision impairment and potential blindness. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today in support of this legislation to help patients throughout Minnesota who rely on prescription medication in the form of eye drops for the preservation of their sight.
Thank you, Dr. Lawrence. Members, any questions? Representative Hilsman.
It's not at the, for this testifier, it's for the author, so whenever you're ready for that.
He looks ready. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know if you can answer this question, but and maybe it's more appropriate to be asked in a health committee, but there are requirements under the ACA that any additional state mandates that are enacted outside an essential benefit set, that benefit must be paid for by the state. So won't there be a cost to CGIP, the State Employee Health Insurance Plan, by doing this? And if not, why not?
Representative Albright. My inclination is that they're just performing a refill on that, and they're still paying for it. But I'm happy to check with the Health Department research and get that answer back to you.
Representative Hilstrom, I believe a fiscal note has been requested, and we are sending this to HHS Finance.
Perfect, Mr. Chair. Then it will be asked there.
Excellent question. I thought you were going to ask if this bill was bad optics. I'm glad you didn't. That would have been terrible.
I can see clearly now.
I'm glad she didn't.
This went to be.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, with that, Representative Albright will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to see this committee again.
You know, it was going well. all right, I will renew my motion that House File 1203 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Dr. Lawrence. Thank you, Representative Albright.
See you later.
Members, we have a quorum. Representative Nash, have you had a chance to examine the minutes from our last meeting?
Mr. Chair, yes, I have. I move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Members, any questions about the minutes from last meeting? Comments, questions, concerns? Seeing none, those in favor of the adoption of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Nash and members. House File 593, Representative O'Driscoll.
Good luck.
Representative O'Driscoll will move the 593 amendment, or will move House File 593. And Representative O'Driscoll, you have a DE1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form that I'd like.
Sounds good. Members will vote on that amendment. Those in favor of the adoption of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Representative O'Driscoll, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is the second in a series of bills that I've carried in the legislature the last few years. The appraisers here in the state of Minnesota, which are governed under Chapter 82B, have put together a working group and in consultation with their members and with others in the appraisal industry and the Department of Commerce and other stakeholders, they have brought forth this bill that I'm carrying. It is a Peace in the Valley bill, and given the interest of time, the health research summary that was prepared, the nonpartisan, does a very good job of laying out the different provisions, and I stand for questions if members have them.
Members, any questions for the author? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify on this bill? You can testify against it. It's okay. With that, Representative O'Driscoll will give you the final word.
I think I've said enough already, Mr. Chair.
Sounds good. With that, Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 593, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same side. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Okay. We're going to... We're going to stall for just 1 second. Members, we're going to do, we have Representative Baker's bill, House File 1043 up. Representative Baker isn't here. We have this bill in our committee. We weren't sure that it needed to come here. We're going to hear it and send it on to, I don't remember where we're sending it, to the Committee on Jobs, where it likely more appropriately belongs. And we're going to do that without Representative Baker, if there's no objection from Representative Slocum or anyone else. And they will have more longer in-depth testimony in the Committee on Jobs. So with that, I will move House File 1043. It is an increase of money for the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. And we have an expert testifier, Ms. Hartnett. Ms. Hartnett, please identify yourself with the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Mary Hartnett. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify before you today to request additional funds for our commission. And I want to thank Representative Baker for his willingness to be chief author of our bill, and for many members of the legislature who also co-signed in a bipartisan manner to support the work that we do. The commission is a non-cabinet agency that has 15 governor-appointed commission members. There are 8 regional advisory members and 7 at-large members, and the majority are deaf, deaf-blind, and hard of hearing. We identify barriers to access and communication, health care, employment, and access to public services. Every 5 years, we develop a strategic plan and set benchmarks and outcomes for each goal. By working together, we have been able to pass over 70 pieces of legislation that improve the lives of people who are deaf, deaf-blind, and hard of hearing. We convene groups that are cross-sector, cross-agency, and at times cross-disability that develop solutions with citizens. We encourage citizens to vote and teach them how to vote, and we make the legislature accessible and advise elected officials on policies that improve access. We monitor progress and advise and assist agencies and the legislature on implementation of laws and policies. Some of our better-known works are our newborn hearing screening and intervention legislation. In 2007, prior to the work that we did, we were in the bottom 5 in our identification and reporting of hearing loss to the CDC. And after our coalition building and recommendations using evidence-based practice, we got a mandate passed, so now the estimated 70,000 babies that are born in the state of Minnesota are all screened for hearing loss and get the interventions they need, including a hearing aid loaner bank, so they have immediate access to amplification, sign language taught in the home, because the majority of parents that have deaf babies born to them don't know sign language and don't have an understanding of how to communicate with their child visually. The end result is that now 99% of all babies are screened. 75% get early intervention before the age of 6 months, and 80% are ready for K. With accessible e-government and legislative services, we got accessibility standards passed for the state IT. Prior to our work, we were at risk for lawsuits. Target had been sued for $7 million. We saw that the state was at risk. We put together a broad-based coalition of stakeholders and identified and developed standards. And some of those you see actually with the legislation that you, when you, there's testimony on the floor and in committee. You see captions on the screen. That's part of our work. Then we increased employment of people with disabilities through an executive order and a centralized accommodation fund prior to our work. We work cross-disability and recognize that our employment levels of people with disabilities had gone down to 3.8%, and we had been at 10% in 1999. We worked with a coalition of cross-disability sectors and agencies and worked on getting an executive order in place with specific milestones and benchmarks that needed to be met, and now we've gone up since 2014 to 6.1%. Those are some of the measurable or more visible pieces of work that we've done. We've distributed a lot of the work before you. You have a copy of some of, specifically year by year, of the work that we've done. Last year, our budget was $1.172 million. $605,000 was for salaries. $467,000 was for interpreters, captioning, ASL video education, education webinars, a statewide education conference for parents and for professionals, rent, equipment, and supplies. And this year, our budget will be $877,000. The $370,000 would be allow us to continue with our education work, to hire a policy director, a permanent one, for because I've been balancing that with running the agency. Professional consultants for implementation of our legislation, including our age-related hearing loss initiative. Some of you have seen that. Some of the work that we've done, we created a documentary on the impact of age-related hearing loss, which two-thirds of everyone over 70 has a significant hearing loss that can lead to accelerated dementia falls. We want to continue that work. Online education and content in ASL, and community outreach consultants to do our work in engagement and training. The funds would come from the Telecommunications Access Minnesota Fund. The fee is currently set at 5 cents. In FY16, the fee was 7 cents. The Department of Commerce is set to cover adjustments for all programs covered by the fund. The fee would have to go up 6 or 7 cents. In your packet, there's a schedule of how this fee has fluctuated over the last 15 years. We ask for your support so we continue the work we do for the citizens of the state, for deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing, and their families.
Thank you, Ms. Hartnett. Nice job. Members, any questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak to this bill, for or against the bill? Seeing none with that, Ms. Hartnett, I will thank you to all the members for, it's a little bit unusual to not have Representative Baker here. He's busy doing some opioid legislation today. So thank you, Representative Slocum and members. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1043 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Ms. Hartnett. You're on your way to the Jobs Committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Representative Nash.
I'd like to move House File 1127 for possible inclusion to be laid over, and I do have an amendment.
Is that the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And I assume that's to put the bill in the shape you'd like it to be in?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Nash, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be very brief, and I'm going to let my testifiers do a lot of the work for me. But this is essentially a bill to create parity for the craft distillers, along with the same opportunities that microbrew and farm wineries have as well. It essentially does three things, and there's a handout in your packet for you. It's an expanded bottle sales, Sunday cocktail rooms, and limited, and I want to stress limited, self-distribution. There are 17 distillers in the Guild, all of whom support this bill. I want to thank my co-authors from this very committee, Representative Lunan, Rosenthal, and Franson. Thank you so much for your support. And, Mr. Chair, I'm going to introduce Mr. Bill Miller, who's brought props.
Mr. Miller, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and honorable representatives of the Commerce Committee. Thank you for allowing me to appear here today. I'm the owner and distiller of J. Carver Distillery in Waconia, Minnesota. With me today is my partner and business manager, Gina Holman, and there are also several other distillery owners and distillers in the audience today with me here. I'm going to speak for a few minutes, and then I'll have two other associates speaking after me briefly as well. A few years ago, Some small changes were made by this legislature that encouraged several entrepreneurs to start up distilleries in the state of Minnesota. There are now about 20 active micro-distilleries in the state of Minnesota. They've invested tens of millions of dollars and created hundreds of jobs in the state. Depending on where each distillery is located, they face common but also different challenges in their efforts to grow and succeed. J. Carver is just one of those distilleries. In addition to creating jobs, we purchase our inputs, our grains, our grapes, our apples, our bottles, our barrels, our labels from local producers, boosting other Minnesota businesses as well. Our facility is very busy on weekends with consumers interested in experiencing our products and with tourists from across the state and outside of the state. Our goal is to convert them into customers of Minnesota-made products as opposed to products made overseas or in other states. In the less than 3 years since we started on this venture, we have commenced production and have developed many unique, interesting products using these local inputs. The products have been well received by a marketplace and community hungry to support Minnesota businesses. But as small businesses, we face a lot of challenges. We compete against really large global and national competitors who often have advertising budgets greater than all the revenues produced by our entire micro-distillery industry. We also compete with micro-distilleries from other states that have more favorable regulation. And even though we collaborate often, we also face competition from local breweries and wineries. Our success is dependent upon creating the opportunity for consumers to taste our products so that they're willing to walk into a liquor store and buy our product when they've never seen it before on TV. The way we do this is we do tours and tastings and try to get people to come into our facilities. Today, the micro distillers of Minnesota are here to request that you consider some modest changes in legislation that will allow the micro distilleries in Minnesota to continue to grow and contribute to the social and economic well-being of our state. We're seeking changes in what products are allowed to be sold on site, the ability to sell some of our products and services on Sundays, and limited distribution to our customers. These are in line with similar laws that Minnesota wineries and breweries have been afforded. Presently, Minnesota micro distilleries are allowed to sell one 375 milliliter bottle per person per day if they come into our site. After traveling many miles, perhaps experiencing an educational tour or a cocktail, being impressed by our businesses and products, they often ask if they can buy a bottle. When we tell them that we're happy to sell them one 375 milliliter bottle per person per day, many express irritation, frustration, and some of them argue with us over, are you crazy? What are you thinking? This is ridiculous. And we have to basically tell them this is the law and this is what we're holding to. For some, their previously enjoyable experience ends on a sour note. They don't buy a bottle and they walk away. Very disappointing for us. For others, they do buy them. Sometimes I think just to be nice to us. Sometimes it just ends up as a novelty on a shelf. And at times it makes our product feel expensive, like a small jar of mayonnaise. Others are willing to buy the products, but they want to buy several. Maybe they want to bring them home because there's several products we have and they like them all. Maybe they want to give them away as gifts. They too are disappointed when we tell them we can only sell one bottle per day. We always try to steer them to local liquor stores in their area, but it's far from certain that the liquor store in their area is going to be carrying all of our products. So very often, the 375 limitation, one per day, means that instead of gaining a customer, we lose the sale and maybe lose the customer forever. There's another challenge that the 375 presents, which is the cost of burdening another size in inventory, the cost of another bottle size, new labeling, and the facility that you have to have to store that many bottles in the back is a burden for a lot of the micro distilleries and especially for smaller ones. It's an unnecessary and significant investment. We are grateful for what's been done for this industry, but we're also doing all we can to make this a very good success story for the state of Minnesota, trying to be a positive impact, and we would appreciate your support for our request.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Members, any questions? Representative Hillstrom. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Odressel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that from your vantage point, you might have had trouble hearing a testifier. We've discussed, we'll take the props on the left side over to this side of the table if it's okay with you. Using the chair line, I thought that'd be funnier than it was.
Representative Driscoll, you're on a timeout. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been supportive of micro-distilleries in the past. But I am very much in favor of the three-tier system. We had Surly that came out of my district, and so Surly kind of broke the mold, showing folks how it is that you can make something different and make it a very successful business and then become actually part of the three-tier system. My question to the distillers is, don't you think there's some risk if you become allowed to produce the product, license it, distribute it, and also have the ability to sell it, that the big folks are going to come in and buy you out, and they are going to own, operate, and sell everything, because that's what they do. Don't you think there's some risk in attempting to put this forward that ultimately you may end up putting yourselves right out of business?
Mr. Miller.
Chairman Hoppe, Representative Hillstrom, a couple thoughts. Number one, we have a very significant limitation on our production capability by law, pretty small. I've had no offers. I'm not expecting any offers. I don't think there's a significant risk of that, and the risk is mitigated by the fact that we're not allowed to produce an unlimited quantity of product. It's a very small amount of product we're allowed to produce.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why do you believe that your industry should be allowed to participate outside the three-tier system that has been so successful here in Minnesota?
Mr. Miller.
Chairman Hoppe, Representative Hillstrom, I think what we're seeking is parity with the breweries and the wineries, and I think these are very modest changes to a three-tier system that wasn't designed to create small companies and produce jobs via small business growth. It was meant to control the industry.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that the state likes to do is to regulate the industry so that they don't have the ability to come in and squish small businesses like yours. I think that this bill is in the wrong direction. I would like to support your industry. I think that this puts your industry tremendously at risk. I can't support your proposal.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Members, other questions? If not, we will go to Michelle Winchester. Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Chairman.
Props remain property of the House Commerce Committee.
It's just water.
You're free to keep that. Ms. Winchester, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Michelle Winchester, and I am the founder and distiller and investor in Twin Spirits Distillery in Northeast Minneapolis. I just started producing last summer, pretty new at it still. And I'm opening my cocktail room this weekend, and I would love to be able to get up after my late night Saturday night on Sunday morning and and start with a brunch. And I think that, again, it is putting us on parity with the breweries and the wineries. I get a lot of calls from folks who want to come in on Sunday and do tours, tagging on with the brewery tours, and I always have to decline it because I can't give them what they want on that tour. So I would like to really see that we get the Sunday sales like the breweries and wineries.
Thank you very much, Ms. Winchester. Members, any questions? With that, thank you very much. Mr. Schneider, welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rick Schneider, and I am the owner, sole employee of Sandy Spirits in Sandy, Minnesota, so I'm about 45 miles north here in a rural area. I operate a very small distillery. I produced less than 1,000 cases last year. I do not operate a cocktail room. My distillery is my backyard where my kids hang out, so I don't want people drinking there. But I'm here to kind of address the issue of limited self-distribution. One of the challenges that a lot of the smaller distilleries face currently in the state of Minnesota is being able to make connections with the businesses that we are trying to sell to. Now, our distributors do a lot of good work in that, and we don't want to separate from them. But what we're looking for are opportunities to kickstart things for them. What I mean by that is if I'm down near Shakopee and I see a liquor store that I'm not in, right now I can't have liquor in the back of my car. So if I went in and talked to them and said, hey, here's my business and what I'm doing, would you be interested in carrying my product? They can say yes, I can direct them to my distributor, but you want to strike when the iron's hot. They're point of sale things to get you to buy something right there, because we know that customers, when they see something and they want it, they buy it. If you don't sell it to them in that first moment, they walk away, they think about other things, life takes over, they can easily forget about you. We're seeking the ability to be able to go to that store, make that first connection, be able to sell them the first case or a couple of bottles, and then be able to direct them to our distributors. It gives us a chance to have direct contact with retailers and make that first sale that's going to give us a competitive edge. Another issue which is really important, and this is looking towards the future of the industry, I hope this would address Representative Hillstrom's question in some degree, is that as this industry grows, it is becoming harder and harder for newer distilleries to be able to get representation from a distribution company. So that means that those companies can be completely locked out of the market. As right now, many of the major distributors are carrying 5, 6, 7 different brands, and trying to become the next one in that suite becomes harder and harder. And what sort of happened with the breweries and the wineries is that they looked for an opportunity to be able to make those first distribution deals, to be able to make those connections, to grow big enough to where a distributor said, hey, now we're ready to carry you. And that is going to be an issue going forward with this industry. One of the things that I really want to sort of keep in the forefront of your mind is that pretty much all of us are family-owned businesses. A couple of them are friendly partnerships, but we're very small, few employees here and there. But we have a huge reach towards Minnesota commerce through the ag products that we buy, the wood that we buy. Bill touched on a lot of those, so I won't go into it too much. But often we have relationships with farmers in our area where we pay better than the grain elevator will pay them. We're buying most of our stuff at a much higher cost, so things that are hard for us to compete are that we have to charge more because we're not buying grain by the rail car, like places like Jack Daniels can do. We're also, what you may not know about this business is that we are less than 1% of the business. I'd even venture to go that we're not even 0.5%. So we're looking for a chance to grow, to keep our money here. One of the important things about local businesses is that when somebody goes into my local municipal store and buys a bottle of my whiskey, 70% of that money stays in that county. It goes to the liquor store, their employees, and to me, and it's invested back in my community. When someone buys a bottle of Jim Beam, that money goes to Kentucky and to a conglomerate in Japan. So this brings money into the county. I just shipped my first pallet into Wisconsin, and many of my colleagues have also started to ship into other states, so we're starting to bring money back into this state. The distribution piece of the puzzle just allows us to grow quicker, to make those first-person connections. Just a few wrap-up comments. I won't keep you any longer. I'll be happy to answer some questions. But what we're really asking for you to do and what we're asking you to support is that spirit of entrepreneurship and small business. It's going to create jobs. Our goal is to be successful and to increase the footprint of Minnesota businesses and the local character that is here in the state. And your supporting this bill will do that and support all of that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Members, any questions? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, thanks for your testimony. You talk about this approach as just being able to kind of get a foot in the door and letting the three-tier system take over is what I heard you say. Do you see a scenario or do you have any intention of us doing away with our three-tier system?
No.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, no. And in all of the discussions that we have had, many of us have tremendous support. My distribution company, which is Vinacopia, I just switched to them from one that was underperforming, and they picked me up and have reinvigorated my business. They're a partnership. And if I were given limited distribution, the first thing I would do is go and sit down with the general manager and ask how to make it work for the two of us. What are the things that they would be comfortable with me doing? What are the things that they would like to see me avoid? Because that relationship is crucial. And part of that, so I'm one person. If I want to really become my own distributor, I have to buy a fleet of trucks. I have to hire a number of guys to be able to do this state. That company already has that. And that's not the business. I think if you asked any one of my colleagues up here, they didn't get into this to get in the business of running a truck fleet. But really, the things that's holding us back the most is awareness and being able to make that immediate connection, especially in bottle sales. When people come to my distillery driving up out of the cities, a lot of them do pass on the 375. I haven't experienced much negativity in that. Mostly they look at me and say, well, I'm going to go grab one at my liquor store, which is my end goal. Is my end goal is that they will taste it, take a sample home from my distillery, and then support their local liquor store. But again, this is a point-of-sale issue. When they're there, they're tasting it, they've heard the story, that's when they're ready to buy. And if they walk out the door without buying that product, that really can be a chance where they won't taste it. Because when they walk into the liquor store, they go back and go, oh, there's my familiar thing, or there's, you know, they can forget that we're even there. So we're asking for the opportunity to really strike that when that iron's hot and when they're excited about what we're telling them. And being able to sell the bottle that they want to buy is going to be a real benefit to us.
Representative Nash, yeah. At this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, maybe an example from my district that is a great example of sort of priming the pump and then turning it over to a distributor. One of our local brewers has seeking parity, they have the ability to do some limited self-distribution. And really what they have done is they have created a sort of an on-ramp for their beers to be picked up through a local distributor, Locker Brothers. They're using that as sort of a prime the pump to get Locker Brothers to take them on fully. And that's what's happened. So Waconia Brewing has limited self-distribution. They took it to various places, made it very popular, and then handed it off to the distributor.
Mr. Schneider.
I just wanted to add one more thing. So a special situation in my county, which is where this is very important to me, is that my county is mostly mom-and-pop shops. The liquor store, we have municipal liquor stores, but our restaurants and bars are largely owned by families. And when I have gone into their locations and shown them, they're all like, hey, this is really great. Who's your distributor? And when I tell them it's not the one distributor that pretty much owns the territory of my county, they say, well, unless I can get it through them or I can buy it directly from you, I don't want to have another distributor because they don't want another bill. They don't want another salesperson trying to sell them 40 other things. They just want to buy mine, but I can't give it to them. So right now in my county, I have one restaurant that's ponied up and done the credit app and gone through the hassle to allow me to do that, and the rest of them are waiting for a chance to be able to buy it directly from me. And that's something, you know, then when they get to a point where they're buying a lot, then I am going to suggest to them, hey, let's get my distributor involved because they're handling quantity. I don't have time to drive around. I have time to make connections and make a sale, but I don't have time to distribute myself.
Representative Halverson, did that answer your question? I have a question, Mr. Schneider. So Vinacopia is your current distributor?
Yes.
Have you ever talked to them about this, about the idea of limited self-distribution? And if you did, what was their reaction, if you don't mind?
I have not discussed that with them. In the last few months as this has come up, I haven't been down to see them. It's a drive for me, and I probably should have called and been able to answer that question for you, but I'm sorry I haven't.
Nope, that's all right. You're doing a nice job. I think it's informative for the committee members. Members, any other questions? Representative Loon.
Thank you. Is it Schneider?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Schneider, so when you were starting out, and I don't know how old your business is, how long you've been around, but did you have difficulty finding a distributor who would take on your product or who was interested?
Mr. Schneider.
Mr. Chair and Representative. At that time, no. When the business first started, there were maybe 10 of us who formed what was the initial beginnings of the Minnesota Distillers Guild when we were very informal when we first came here. And when we started at the beginning, there was an excitement that it was going. I mean, I was able to have a conversation with pretty much every distributor. Once it now has started to roll, those conversations are even harder for some of us who are established if we want to make changes. I had an underperforming distributor who I gave months and months of opportunities to, and when I went to Vinicopia, that was, you know, it was, when we sat down to talk about what was going to go forward, it was within the discussion of what brands they had. Did I have something to offer that was new and outside of what they do? Now, I'm very fortunate in that I have one of the oldest whiskeys in the state. My rye whiskey is a four-year-old. So I had a product that they did not have available from another craft distiller, and that was what got me in the door. If I didn't have that, I very well may have been passed on.
Representative Loon.
Thank you. And just one other question. So I, not being in this industry, and that, what is it like when you go to meet with or try to find a distributor? What kind of arrangement is it? Is it you're telling them what kind of stores you'd like to be in, or they're telling you how much of your product they think they can place? Can you explain that, kind of that relationship a little bit?
Mr. Chair and Representative, you pretty much have touched on all the things that go into that conversation. In most cases, I would guess from my colleagues, I don't know all of their stories, but in my case, I called a number of them. I had a friend who managed some restaurants in the St. Paul and Twin Cities area, so he had some connections, was able to set up appointments. At that time, when it was fresh and new, they wanted to hear what we had. We had discussions about how many cases would you likely sell. I mean, as you're trying to plan your budget and what you can do, you have to feed off what a distributor honestly thinks they can do for you. In my case, I've wound up with one who didn't even perform at a minimal level that allowed me to pay my bills, to be honest. And you know, right now, my business has now operated for 2 years. I've been in the distilling business for five. I went to Michigan State University, so I'm one of the few people with a college basis in what I do. And I have not paid myself a dime in 2 years, and I would be shocked if anyone up there could tell you that. We are fighting to stay alive. We are fighting to pay our bills. And this is the thing. Awareness, getting people to know we're here, and making those connections are just crucial to the success of our businesses.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. With that, members, if there are no other questions, Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the name of your business? Isani Spirits.
Thank you, sir. Nice job testifying. Thanks for your information for all of us.
Thank you, Chair, and I want to thank Representative Nash for introducing this and for you guys giving us the time to speak our piece.
Our pleasure. Thank you. With that, Mr. Kaplan, if you would, Mr. Kaplan, if you want to come down and. Mr. Ambassador, always a pleasure. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative Hoppe. Thank you, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard. I've represented the wine and spirits wholesalers for a lot of years. Excepting for the time in Morocco, I've represented them for over 35 years. It's a good industry. It's an industry that has worked from the beginning of time being the end of Prohibition, with the three-tier system. And it has worked in the state of Minnesota in particular. This is an industry that is free of corruption. It is an industry that is open to those who will enter it. It's fair. People are treated well. And the size of the alcohol and gambling division is very small because there are no serious problems. In 2015, we were asked whether the 375 bottles were acceptable to us. And we said no, because we believed in the three-tier system, and if you walk away from the system, you're going to damage its integrity. And we were told that those who manufactured needed to do this in order to essentially sell samples of their product to develop it. And I said, mark my word, they will return soon enough and they will ask for something larger. And that is exactly what has happened here. And I think it's very important to keep that in mind. I think the rules of the game are known when you enter the industry. There are no secrets. You pay for your employees, you pay for your supplies, and you get into the operation as the same and the same basis as others have. It is unfair to people who have been in this industry working hard all through these years on the basis of rules that have applied and now to change those rules. I understand the idea of changing rules. Some industries need to have their rules changed. We changed the rules to regulate the banking industry. We changed the rules to regulate the healthcare industry. We changed the rules for operating in the automotive industry. But this industry works. I've heard two or three of you mention the three-tier system. That's essentially what we are talking about. These are wonderful people who you've heard testify today. Godspeed. I hope that they do well. I hope they make a lot of money. But they must play by the same rules as others have played until now. And I think that that's a key element to all of this. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Members, any questions? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ambassador Kaplan, thank you for your testimony. You know, Representative Nash, when I was, when the distillers came and talked to me, they talked about being able to sell in the cocktail room and, you know, sort of just on site. They mentioned nothing about the distribution. So is it your intent to bypass the three-tier system?
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rosenthal, the bill hasn't changed since you first signed on to it, but that provision was in there. And my intent is not to bypass the three-tier system. As I've said, you know, having this limited self-distribution is to prime the pump, just like the wineries have and just like the small brewers have, to put out some samples or to get some people interested to drive the larger distribution up through the three-tier system.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ambassador, how would you respond to the wine and the beer examples?
I think that was not a well thought out approach either, but I would acknowledge that there's a difference between spirits and wine and beer, a substantial difference. You only have to drink it to know that.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I hope that these distillers do really, really well. I was on board for the cocktail rooms, for the off-sale license, but the distributorships are really disturbing to me. So I think I'll be striking my name from the bill, and I wish the distillers good luck.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Members, any other questions? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kaplan, so again, I'm trying to get a handle on, within the three-tier system, I think that we all, as we understand it, a distiller makes a product, and then the distributor takes that product to a retailer. Let's say, I have no idea what it costs, but let's say that bottle that from the Carver distillery that was there, the 750, it retails for $25. Could you tell me what the breakdown is between what the producer would make on that $25 bottle, what the wholesaler makes, and what the retailer would make?
No, I can't, Mr. Chairman, Representative. I cannot because it depends on the product. It varies greatly from place to place and from product to product. There are some very expensive products where the profit margin is higher. It's also important to keep in mind that we have a completely unique situation in the state of Minnesota. all spirits are subject to being sold by all wholesalers. It creates a much more competitive edge than you have in other states, but operating on what has been frequently called the Coleman Act of 1974, the rules of the game were changed. If I may add one other thought, and that is that I believe everyone who will testify before you today, when you will ask, do you believe in the three-tier system, will respond, I do, and we don't want to change it. And yet they do want to change it. It is easy enough to say, but it is not compelling unless the bills associated with it are consistent. Did I answer your question?
Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair, well, I think, you know, sort of. And maybe it's a fairer question for one of the distillers to talk about what their costs and what they make on a bottle and how it goes up the chain. But I guess, you know, reflecting on your comments, and yes, I mean, we have the three-tier system that we have made changes to it over the years, tweaks and that. But in reflecting on some of those changes, I'll talk about the taproom bill, which I think was one of the first big changes, and that was definitely not embraced by yourself or some other folks on that issue. But, you know, what I've seen from it is that we have an explosion in the number of craft brewers in the state, you know, buying products to produce their beer, hiring people. It's been overall a good thing. And I guess I'm not aware of any job losses or, you know, something that's been detrimental to the other two tiers in the system. Is there some evidence to that you could share with us?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the next person who comes will ask for something more. It is a slippery slope argument. In every single state where this has occurred, it starts out small and it has grown to be larger. Look, what we want to do is we want to collect taxes in the state of Minnesota and we want businesses to be law-abiding. We have a system that works. Godspeed to the people who have started these new businesses. I believe in them. But when they entered in accordance with the set of rules that existed at the time, and we have every right to expect that they, as did my clients, comply with the rules as they follow their future plans.
Representative Loon?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kaplan. And I respect your point of view on this, and I think yes, there are certainly a set of rules out there, but I think also as a legislative body, a part of our responsibility is to look out for the interests of small businesses and entrepreneurs that want to start up in this state and what it may take for them to be successful. And if some changes can be made in a way that is not causing harm, that can be demonstrated to other businesses, that is something that I think we have a responsibility to do, and I think that's kind of what we're trying to get at here is part of this hearing. So, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would simply point out that we have, as you'll hear from other witnesses, people in the retail business who are struggling to make a living by playing by the rules that they accepted when they went into the business. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying the playing field is level only when people play by the same rules that were applicable at the time each entered the industry.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Members, any other questions? With that, we'll go to Mr. Chesick. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Sure, these can stay if you really wish.
Well, now what do I do? Mr. Chesick, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Tony Chesick. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association. The MLBA represents liquor stores and bars across the state, run by families that most of those folks live in your communities. I come here today to discuss House File 1127 and to specifically oppose Section 2 of that bill that would change the allowable bottle size that the distillery could sell for off-site consumption from a 375-milliliter bottle to a bottle of any size. I want to provide some explanation for our concern and opposition. In 2008, the license for a distiller was lowered in Minnesota from $30,000 to $1,000. For distillers that made less than 40,000 proof gallons of distilled spirits per year, shortly after that reduction, Minnesota distilleries began to develop in the state of Minnesota. In short order, these new distilleries sought a cocktail room to mirror the brewery tap rooms and the ability to sell straight to the consumers at retail by selling a bottle. The new producers all sought to make exceptions to the traditional three-tiered system to allow them to transport their own product, sell straight to the consumer, either on-site or by allowing the sale of a bottle for off-site consumption. The arguments have been that these exceptions were included. It will only be for small producers. We need this exception to help us get off the ground. It will be good for bars and liquor stores because this will help create new customers that will ask for their product at those stores. And we need to be able to promote our product. The MLBA's concern has always been that the rules and regulations are not altered so much that we create an unfair playing field where traditional liquor stores and bars are at a competitive disadvantage to new retailers that don't operate under the same playing field. Bluntly, our concern is that changes to the existing, well-settled regulations do not create new powerful liquor stores or bars that are licensed differently and have less costs embedded in getting the product to the consumer. Thus, with these concerns in mind, with each new manufacturer, small wineries, breweries, and distilleries, we sought to figure out how we could meet the desires of the new manufacturer to sell direct to the customer without creating competitors that opted for a different set of rules and costs. In the case of small brewers, growlers are larger than normal, and the product goes bad within a few days of purchase. The product is a niche product that has allowed brewers to promote their product and make revenue to help the brewery get off the ground. In the case of a distillery, the product does not go bad. There are a few standard sizes that exist in the industry. Put a few of them up here for you folks to check out. Thus, in trying to find the middle ground, 2 years ago, Panther Distillery proposed the sale of a 375-milliliter bottle. The most common size sold in Minnesota is a 750 right here to my left, to wherever you're sitting to your right, I would assume. At the time, we were concerned about this. However, since then, we believe that this was the middle ground. It isn't the smallest size sold, but it still allows the product to be sold in a decent size without creating a situation where a competitor is competing with products that are obtainable. We think the new sizes set out in this legislation go too far and creates that unlevel playing field as discussed, where a supplier now becomes a competitor and the distillery now becomes a liquor store. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chesick. Members, any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chesick, so that 750 bottle, I can come into the liquor store when it's open every day of the week and buy that, correct?
Soon, yes.
Okay. Well, yeah, assuming.
Correct.
Okay. But I couldn't buy a 750 bottle for any of the breweries that are listed on this list here. Correct?
For the distilleries?
The distilleries, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, correct. That is correct.
Okay. So we're limiting one, but you can do it any time that you want to do it. You can.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, the store has the ability to sell any size that is produced from the manufacturer, correct?
Great. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chesick. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Other questions? Not seen any. Thank you, Mr. Chesick. Mr. Reynoso, we have one more testifier. Mr. Reynoso, welcome back to the committee. And before you start, if there's anybody else that wants to speak for or against the bill, if you want to, wave or come down or get ready, we'll not seen anybody. Mr. Reynoso, it looks like you're batting cleanup.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the committee.
And let me preface my testimony by saying thank you at the beginning of the committee hearing today. You had said that Representative Albright's House File 1203 was your favorite bill.
Well, that was only while he was here.
So, nonetheless, my name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. We represent over 62,000 active and retired members in the state of Minnesota, many within the liquor industry, whether warehousing. We actually, in some cases with beer, we make beer, we distribute beer, liquor of all types, distilleries, distilled spirits, and so forth. I come here today to testify in opposition to this bill and the following bill, the micro craft brew bill, somewhat in the same stance in that we're certainly concerned with the breakdown of the three-tier system. You know, Mr. Kaplan testified a little while ago and had said that, used the term that, oh, I'm sorry, it was actually Representative Nash that used the term prime the pump. And for the last probably 10 years, at least 8 years, we've been hearing the same thing in this industry and in the craft brew industry. And I just want to go back even further than Mr. Kaplan and go back to when we were talking about micro distilleries. They got them. A couple years later, the same people came and they said, well, you know, we want to be able to pass out samples. We want to be able to give them a sample because if they can't taste it, well, they're not probably not going to buy it. They got it. The next year they came back and said, well, we want to be able to mix it. We want to be able to create a cocktail room so that we can mix it, and that way they can realize what it tastes with another product. They got it. Then they came back and wanted a 375 milliliter bottle, just like this right here, and to hand out as a sample. Now, they originally wanted a 750 milliliter bottle as a sample. That's not a sample. That can get quite a few of us drunk here, including the 375. That's no longer a sample. So now they want more. And so we say, what's next? What's next? A gallon? Where do you draw the limit? The reality is that these micro distilleries want a competitive edge. And I heard one of the gentlemen say that his goal is to get into the liquor store. Well, if you want to get it in the liquor store, why do you want to sell a 750 milliliter bottle when you can send them down the street to your local liquor store and they can buy it there? Now, let me say that we recently had a bill that came through this committee, Sunday sales. And I'm sure everybody noticed, I didn't come up and testify. It's a tough issue. It's a difficult issue. And while we didn't testify in opposition, there's some grave concerns in the liquor industry, specifically with the impact of small business throughout our entire state. Now, there's no question Sunday sales is going to negatively impact some liquor stores, especially the mom-and-pop stores in greater Minnesota. Now, on the same day, we heard Representative Anderson's bill on Internet sales. Again, another avenue which is going to put pressure on those mom-and-pop liquor stores. Now we have another thing. We're expecting these small businesses to withstand all these pressures, all these competitive edges by whether it's a craft brew or a micro distillery. Where do we draw the limit? Where do we say, you know what, now you're taking one business and making it very hard to compete for the sake of making it a little bit nicer for somebody else? It's picking winners and losers. And to the extent of impacting this industry, look, this industry has been impacted severely within the last 6 to 8 years. Representative Loon, Mr. Chair, Representative Loon had mentioned earlier that there hasn't been a significant impact. I would like to say, Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, there has been. If you ask your liquor stores, many of them have lost anywhere from 10 to 20% of their beer industry, beer sales. That's an impact. Those are jobs. So I would say if laws are going to be changed, understand the full implication of the laws that are going to be changed, especially in this industry. This is an industry that's been around that's worked under these guidelines for over 80 years. If it's broken, why are you going to try to fix it for the sake of a few at a disadvantage for many? So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm willing to take any questions, and I wanted to keep it short. I plan on testifying in the next bill also.
Thank you, Mr. Reynoso. I won't comment on your brevity, but always a pleasure to have you, sir. Members, any questions for Mr. Reynoso? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's this particular hearing, I feel like we're getting to a bigger issue that perhaps we need to have a larger conversation about, and that is how many ways do you pull on the three-tier system before it collapses? How many pieces of the Jenga tower do you take out before it collapses? And as I think about this and as I'm listening, it's we regulate this industry because we're talking about intoxicating liquors, and those types of products need to be regulated by the state. They need to be regulated by the federal government. And so in Minnesota, we've talked for years about how to do that. And now, you know, a lot of us are big fans of the craft industry and want to see our local businesses succeed. So we're looking at the businesses evolving. But just saying what I want when I want it is challenging when we're talking about this particular product. So I definitely hear and understand those concerns. Can you comment at all, Mr. Reynoso, about where we're at today and where we're maybe going with the three-tier system, what the consequence is going to be if this ends up, if we pull the wrong Jenga block and it collapses?
Mr. Reynoso.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, you know, I think we're really at a balance point where this industry is really worried about the direction of where we're going. And I say that because, you know, you think about the three-tier system and how it's been successful throughout the last 80 years. With the recent passage, look, I mean, I don't know what the other body is going to do with Sunday sales. But if it passes, we're very, very concerned with what comes next. The fact that next session, the grocery chains are going to be right there knocking on your door to get liquor in grocery stores. And not only wine and beer, they're going to want the whole shebang. So we're worried about that. And the reason we're worried about that is that what they're going to do is try to direct ship directly from the manufacturer to warehouse it within Super Value or Costco or whoever it is. And that would certainly circumvent the three-tier system, which has been challenged in other states. So we're very concerned from the distributorship. I don't speak on behalf of the distributors, but as an organization that represents those folks that work there, we're very concerned. 850 good-paying union jobs that provide great wages, phenomenal wages, benefits, and pensions, being traded for what? Now, I know these craft, the micro distilleries and the craft brewers will come up and say that they've created a lot of jobs, but what type of jobs? Server jobs that pay maybe $12-$13 an hour? I don't know. But I can guarantee you I'm willing to put side-by-side a good Teamster union job at one of those warehouses with any of their serving jobs, period. We're really concerned.
Thank you, Mr. Reynoso. Representative Halverson, good enough answer. Members, any other questions? With that, Representative Nash, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You know, these are 17 distillers from around the state. They're your neighbors. They're buying grains from within your district. And all we're trying to do is create parity. And with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. And with that, House File 1127 will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus liquor bill. And with that, we're on to our final bill of the day. Is Representative Christensen. Here he is. Representative Christensen, House File 1078. Representative Christensen, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1078.
That's probably a good idea.
And with that, Representative Christensen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I brought several testifiers to run through the various parts of the bill, but just in opening, I'll talk a little bit about the bill. We're here to support consumer choice at brew pubs, support smooth growth of small breweries, and provide flexibility for brewers and consumers. You know, this bill is about allowing small businesses to thrive and allowing them to create jobs and grow Minnesota's economy.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Mr. Wisnan, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, my name is Tom Wisnan. I am president of the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild and co-founder of Indeed Brewing Company, Minnesota's about fifth largest craft brewer here in the state. The Craft Brewers Guild, I help represent over 100 small independent craft brewers, many of which sell growlers, which is something we'll talk about today. At Indeed Brewing Company, we started in 2012, and we're really pretty much one of the first breweries to start with one of these tap rooms. And what we've seen is this tremendous growth. Hearing comments in previous testimony and other bills, I will say you don't brew 14,000 barrels of beer with just low-paying server jobs. All of our members do have jobs associated with them, and many of them pay well, especially when they grow into manufacturing businesses that do contribute into that three-tier system. But today we're mainly here to talk about growlers. And it's amazing how a small brown jug can be such a hot subject and such a controversial one. But we're no dummies. We realize that, you know, there is this complicated system here with the three-tier system, and breweries have grown a lot in the last 5 years. And it's kind of surprising, I think, and people wonder what's going to happen. Overall in Minnesota, we've seen an overall about 0.6% increase last year, or decrease in overall beer sales across the board. But that includes macro brewers, while Minnesota breweries have seen a 5 or 6% increase in volume last year. So what's happening? We're bringing in less beer from out of the state, and we're selling more in the state. And much of that is going through the three-tier system. There have been previous changes to this growler law. In 2014, we increased the cap, where once you got to a certain level, you couldn't sell anymore. And at the time, we increased that cap, and we thought, wow, you know, it'll be great if we ever get there. And today, we've had more breweries pass through that cap, and my brewery as well is about to pass through there. But what's interesting about that isn't that Indeed or Fulton are selling more and more growlers, and that's why they're passing through that cap. In fact, the traditional kind of growth trajectory of one of these breweries like Fulton or Indeed is that we're selling less beer in growlers every day that we grow. And we're selling more beer through that three-tier system. And it's not necessarily something we want to change for those members who are running up against that cap. Last year, in fact, growlers only represented 1.4% of our revenue as a brewery. And they remained flat throughout the year, but we grew 20% as a brewery, and almost all of that in Minnesota, and almost all of that in the metro area. So what we're seeing is really when we hit this cap now at 20,000 barrels, which indeed, as I mentioned, is at 14,000 barrels, we're being punished for growth. We're not selling more growlers, like I said. We're selling the same amount of growlers. And yes, it's only 1.4% of our revenue, but for Indeed, that's about $160,000 a year. And you talk about good-paying jobs. Let's say I have a 30% profit margin. There's a good-paying job right there. There's room in there for that good-paying job, and it does take time to fill these growlers and make that beer. The other thing about this whole kind of situation for these breweries, which we're not proposing the abolition of the three-tier system or drastic change of it, is there's this triple whammy that hits breweries like Fulton or Indeed and others, where when we get to that 20 to 25,000 barrel mark, not only do we lose growlers, which is a small part of revenue but a big connection to our customer, we also are, you know, we have to switch to a traditional wholesaler. We have to give up our self-distribution, which gives up about 22% of our margin on average. We also encounter a cost of goods increase on barrelage sold beyond that level, which is a 4% increase usually for a cost of goods sold, at least the way I calculate it. So we're happy paying our taxes, our excise tax, and we're happy working in that three-tier system when we get there, because priming the pump is a good thing. Indeed Brewing Company, my brewery, has, you know, established the largest self-distributor in the state, and we're excited to work with someone in the three-tier system when it's time. And when it comes time, we're going to hand over a brewery, a brand, to that distributor that's really valuable to them, that delivers a high margin profit to those liquor store owners and bars, and a good product to sell, that employs local Minnesotans, indeed employs 56 people at this point, the majority of which are full-time, you know, salaried or hourly professional jobs. We have about a little over a dozen servers in our tap room. So that's really lay of land. We'd also like to see a few other changes, or a couple other changes to the growler law, not just the production cap. One is to slightly increase the types of packages that we can sell. Currently, we're limited to a 64-ounce growler and a 750-milliliter bottle. So we're mixing the imperial and the metric system. A 750-milliliter bottle is 25.4 or 6 ounces. And they're very expensive, these bottles. They're rare. They're not a common bottle in beer. They're really a wine vessel. And so most of our brewers buy these bottles out of Canada. And on average, when you get them all labeled and all said and done, that's $2 for that bottle that you can sell. And we'd like to see that number go down to just a half liter to 2 liters. And in that half liter range, up to 2 liters is, for example, a 22-ounce bottle, which is much more affordable for these breweries to purchase, easier to acquire, and less burdensome for them. And basically, you know, prevents that cost from getting passed on to that customer as well. And up to 2 liters, just because some people have these really ornate growlers, which, you know, is just barely above 64 ounces, and we have to say we can't fill them because they're just this much more. And the last item is really to accommodate some of our members who have rather unique business models. And they're business models that don't necessarily look to go into the three-tier system. These are smaller breweries like Dangerous Man, from who you'll get testimony from later, who are really a neighborhood brewery. They have no intention to distribute beer far and wide. They maybe sell to one or two local bars at the most, and they sell growlers out of their brewery. And they're coming up against that 500-barrel limit per year cap, which for them, you know, I understand the argument that, well, you want to sell more, you should jump into the three-tier system. But for a brewery like that, that doesn't want to grow to be a big brewery, like a big small brewery like Indeed or Fulton, it's punishing to do so. It makes no sense for them to go out there and try to support these accounts. It's a lot of effort to work in that system. So it's basically, well, you can either stop growing or you can go with the three-tier system and the distributors, which for the majority of our brewers and those brewers that are growing that represent a large, you know, economic chunk of the craft beer sales in the state, we're doing that, and we're happily doing it. In fact, Indeed isn't just a self-distributor. We work with seven other distributors here in the state of Minnesota, and very happily have great relationships. So, Mr. Chair, that's my comments for now. I'd be happy to take some questions for anyone.
Thank you, sir. Nice job testifying. Members, any questions? If not, thank you. And Ms. Bonnewood? Welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Sarah Bonvillet. I am secretary of the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild. I am also co-owner of Dangerous Man Brewing Company, a small tap room in Minneapolis. The bill that we are presenting and the piece that I'm going to speak to, for all tap rooms and breweries in the state of Minnesota, the current limit for off sale is 500 barrels per year. That's 15,000 gallons. This may sound like a lot, but as the owner of Dangerous Man Brewing Company, our small tap room that produces less than 0.01% of the craft beer in the state, we are dangerously close to this limit. Not pun intended. As a small tap room that produces 2,000 barrels per year, this limit is an extreme hindrance to our current model and our customer base. Tom kind of outlined one of the arguments about us, you know, why don't we get bigger? Why don't we just grow bigger? We love being small. We run a very tiny brewery. And we like it that way. It affords my family life a healthy balance. It affords our community in Northeast Minneapolis an amazing place to get together. We really just don't want to get bigger. So one of the scenarios I'm very scared for in the future is if this year we hit that 500-barrel limit, we're probably going to hit it in October or November. And that means come Christmas time, which is one of our busiest times, we're going to have to tell our customers, I'm sorry, we cannot sell you any more growlers or crowlers or any of the off-sale items that you are used to selling, you know, used to buying, because we've hit this limit that the state has outlined. And to be honest, they're not going to be mad at you. They're going to be mad at me. And I'm not going to have a good answer for that. So that's a scenario that is very, very real for us. And even though we're a small brewery, we are going to be hindered by the current ruling. I do want to say that even though we are small, our business contributes majorly to the economic impact of craft beer in this state. We employ 25 people at Dangerous Man. And just to make a comment about low-paying server jobs, our servers with tips make $30 an hour. So I would like to counter that, you know, we have an incredibly high-paid, highly intelligent staff. We cover 50% of health insurance costs for all of our full-time employees. We're very proud of that fact. We're only 4 years old, and we're able to do that. We have a volunteer program that rivals Surly's volunteer program. We clean up our neighborhood. We package food for the shelters. We do an unbelievable amount of hard work in our community. We hire a lot of local contractors to fix the many things that go wrong. Running a small manufacturing plant in the city of Minneapolis, lots of things break, and we need a lot of help. We also work with local artists, screen printers, restaurateurs, and many local other businesses to create an incredible web of economic impact. And like I said, this is from a business that contributes 0.01% to the craft beer in Minnesota. So as a board member of the Minnesota Craft Brewers Association and as an owner of Dangerous Man Brewing Company, I urge you to look over this bill and also look into why some of these numbers were created. We're here to stay. We want to be a fair player in this industry. We bring jobs. We bring an incredible amount of tourism to our state and an incredible amount of pride. I would say that Minnesota is for sure in the top 10 states for craft beer, and that's something that I think our state can be incredibly proud of. So we would just like to be fairly considered when laws are being constructed or reconstructed that impact our business. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Ms. Bonvalet.
Yeah.
How's that? Better that time, huh?
That was great.
See, I learned. Karen shocked me. I'm just kidding. Members, any questions? Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question about how much beer, craft beer, we're talking about here. If we want to change the number of barrels from 20,000 to, 250,000 barrels, how much beer are we talking about here in terms of, we've been talking about the percentage of the industry that you are. What would that mean to the industry of beer if we make it more than 10 times greater?
Representative Hillstrom and Ms. Bonvalet, you can answer that, but that might be a better question for the next testifier if you want to. Well, let's ask it of everybody.
Whoever wants to answer, Mr.
Sure.
Chair.
Ms. Bonvalet, if you want to take a crack at it, otherwise we...
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I am going to allow someone that is better suited to answer that question. Like I said, we are very small, so... that part of the bill doesn't affect kind of the small breweries of my size.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But your testimony was that you are going to reach the cap and that it's prohibiting your business from growing. So how much would you intend to grow? Everybody that gets to expand this, right, is all this beer is outside the three-tier system, and everyone's testifying that the three-tier system is, you know, a great system. So my question is, you know, how much are you going to grow and still stay outside of the three-tier system?
Ms. Bonvalet.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So clarifying that, there's a couple different pieces of this bill. The piece that I was speaking to was raising the cap of the 500-barrel off-sale limit. And so that piece is kind of for a small brewers who do kind of the small amount of off sale and reaching that cap. My business actually won't increase by very much, to be honest. So we can only brew about 2,000 barrels a year at Dangerous Man. We're just limited on size. We're in a very old small bank building, and it's the way we're set up. So it's kind of a balance of on-sale and off-sale for us. And what we're hitting is that we're about to hit that limit of what we can sell in off-sale. So it's more of a balancing for us. For the other piece of the bill, raising the cap from 20,000 barrels up, I will defer that to those breweries where that part, that they are more affected by that.
Representative Christensen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it is a little bit confusing because there are two caps in the bill that we're talking about. There's the 20,000 cap that the brewery is allowed to, they have to stay under that to be able to be allowed to sell growlers. And the other cap is if they are under the 20,000 barrels and they're allowed to sell growlers, they can only sell 500 barrels worth of growlers under current law. So this both removes the 500 barrel restriction so they can sell as many barrels worth essentially of growlers. It removes that cap and it raises the other cap under which they're allowed to sell growlers from 20,000 to 250,000. And that might have also been confusing, so feel free to ask clarified questions.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe you're the person to answer the question then about why that amount and how much beer you're intending to keep outside the three-tier system.
Representative Christensen.
Mr. Chair, I think the testifier can better answer the conversion rate of barrels to growlers.
And Representative Hillstrom, if that's okay, I have one more, well, actually two quick questions for Ms. Bombalay, and then we'll have the next testifier to get to your question. When we're talking about the 500-barrel limit, under state law now, just for our edification, to whom does that apply?
To all breweries that do any off-sale at their tap room.
Right, and brew pubs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. And so then, I know you were worried about the limited hitting the limit, so is that on the honor system, or does somebody come by and check every day to see how many barrels that you've produced?
It is on the honor system.
Thank you, Ms. Bombalay, and appreciate it. Other questions for this testifier? Seeing none, with that, we'll hear from somebody that can probably answer more directly Representative Hillstrom's question. Mr. Petz, welcome back to the committee. It's okay. Apparently, we're getting new furniture. Don't worry about it.
A new building, I hear. Chairman Hoppe and representatives, thank you for having me back. It's an honor to be here. I think I first testified in this building about 6 years ago, so it's been quite the ride since then. My name is Ryan Petz. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Fulton Brewing. We started our company in a Southwest Minneapolis garage in 2009. As I said, it's been an exciting ride since then. We've actually built not one but two breweries within Minneapolis city limits, of which we both currently still are operating and attempting to grow. I'm also the treasurer and a board member of the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild, along with my peers here. Maybe to start just by clarifying the point that we were touching on last, there are two components of this, of the current legislation. The size of a brewery that is allowed to sell growlers and the amount of growlers that any brewery can sell if they are allowed to sell growlers. So that first number, that is currently at 20,000 barrels. If you are a brewery producing beer and selling it anywhere and you sell one barrel more than 20,000, you can no longer sell any growlers in Minnesota. That's the situation that my company found ourselves in this past year. We surpassed 20,000 barrels. We hit about almost 27,000. And as a result, we were no longer able to maintain our growler license. Those who are able to have that license are subject to being only able to sell up to 500 barrels of beer in growlers themselves. So maybe to clarify what we're talking about here, it's changing both of those numbers. One, the 20,000 barrel threshold allowing any brewery to sell growlers up to 250,000 barrels. That number has been discussed and selected by us to exactly match the limit on the size of a brewery that can operate a taproom, on-premise sales. Does that hopefully clarify a little bit?
Mr. Petz, I think it does, but one other part, and Representative Hillstrom, I think this is what you're getting at. How many growlers come in each barrel? And I mean, if this increases, what kind of overall, what kind of increase in beer production are we potentially looking at? And I know it's hard to put a number on the upper cap, but...
I'm not sure I totally understand the nature of the question in that, I can answer a couple things. There are approximately 60 growlers in one barrel of beer. Since it's kind of a two-part issue, removing the 20,000 barrel threshold from breweries that are allowed to sell growlers and putting that up to 250,000 barrels currently would affect five breweries in the state. There are about 125 breweries in Minnesota in total. Fulton, of course, is one of them. We're the fifth largest in production volume. The next four include Cold Spring / Third Street Brewery, Summit, Shells, and Surly. So that piece of the legislation would allow five breweries who currently don't sell growlers to potentially choose to sell growlers. The other piece, amount of growlers we can sell. My colleague Sarah just spoke about her situation. I can tell you that in Fulton's situation, we never approached that 500 barrel cap. So I'm not sure in most situations, in most breweries I should say, I don't think that really would even come into play for business models like ours and other similar breweries that are more production and distribution oriented. For Fulton, we sell over 85% of our production volume to distributors and bars and liquor stores in Minnesota and other states, but primarily in Minnesota. And again, it's 85% that over 85% that leaves our doors.
Representative Hillstrom, is that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm trying to get a sense of here is some of the testimony has been that, you know, they're less than 1% of all of the beer in the system. So my question is, how much beer are we talking about here? These are changing the rules after Surly has already followed all the rules and had their growth model, and now we're looking at a different model for five businesses, and I'm curious as to then why. How much beer are we talking about, and why are we changing the whole system for five?
Well, Representative Hillstrom, Surly did change the rules, and second of all, we don't really know. It just depends. Nobody's going to come close to that 250,000 mark of the Fulton is the biggest other than Summit and Shells and Cold Spring right now. I think, and they're not, I think the number was 27,000?
Correct, slightly under.
Okay, so nobody's anywhere close to this, and, you know, I think the number is something that we're still discussing, but if it went to 250,000 with 100, and, I mean, hypothetically, with 125 breweries, that's an awful lot of beer, but realistically, we're never going to get anywhere close to that number. Most of those breweries will never get that big. They'll be... You know, a lot of them will turn into nice little profitable breweries, but that's a lot of work and a lot of beer to get to be that size of a brewery.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then the question is, why these numbers? If your testimony, Mr. Chair, is that we're never going to get to these numbers, why these numbers?
I think, Representative Hillstrom, because America is an aspirational country. We dream. And, you know, I think it's one of those things that's one of the things that we're talking about, you know. And I don't know, I didn't pick the number, it's not my bill, but I'm just, you know, having worked on these issues for a number of years, you know, the numbers keep changing and getting bigger. And I think what happens is, I don't know where we are in terms of number of breweries, if it's bigger or less than it was, but it's not any of us in this room that are doing this. It's all the people out there that want to drink different beer. And some of the breweries are never going to be very big, but it's fun to go there. Some make really good local beers. Some are going to grow. And, you know, the people that grow and want to get bigger want to get into the system and want to be, you know, have their beer in bars and restaurants and liquor stores all over the state. Representative Applebaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the author.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Christensen, you misspoke earlier. I'm not sure if it was intentional or not, but you, in some of the numbers, and I understand the bill wasn't written in the most coherent way, but you said that this bill would raise the 500 milliliter barrel per year limit, but but in reality it just eliminates it completely. Is that right?
Representative Christensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Applebaum, I said it would eliminate it, and that is what it does.
Representative Applebaum.
Well, I'm glad that you think so now. Thank you.
Representative Applebaum, thank you for that clarification. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Christensen, for authoring this legislation. I think it's a great step forward in recognizing the booming craft industry that we have here in Minnesota. I love to see people achieve their dreams of having their small business grow and employ good people in the state of Minnesota. My question, though, is for Mr. Petz, and, you know, can you talk through, you know, when it's talking about the growler and lifting that, you know, are people stockpiling growlers? Is there a freshness issue with it? Is this something that they're bringing back home and they're, you know, going to drink for the next month, or is this something that it's just an occasional use or somebody maybe is trying it out?
Mr. Petz.
Chairman and Representative Anderson, I think that's a great question. The nature of a growler is, I think it was actually referenced in the previous bill, it's somewhat of a niche item and a novelty item in that growlers are designed to be purchased fresh and consumed fresh. I would never, as a brewer and beer fan, recommend that you buy a growler from Fulton and take it home and store it for several months or a year. All beer is best consumed fresh in almost all cases, and especially because of the nature of the growler packaging, growlers especially so. In our experience, growlers are, again, sort of a niche, almost a novelty item of it's what you do when you buy a brewery. When you visit a brewery, you buy a T-shirt and you take home a growler. Fulton, as I said, lost our ability to sell growlers at the end of September of last year, and yet we still see people coming in with their growler that they might have purchased a year ago or 3 years ago, and they haven't visited since, but they were in the neighborhood and they happened to remember to bring their growler, and they come in and we're now in the position that we have to tell them, I'm sorry, we can't fulfill that anymore. Another just quick example, there are many people that visit a brewery that are perhaps from out of town or out of state who want to bring home a kind of a piece of memorabilia from that brewery and of course, hopefully some beer within that. So a growler is kind of a, because it's the nature of the container, is a great thing to bring some beer home, serve it, and then put on your shelf as sort of that little memento.
Thank you. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this question may or may not be for this testifier, but I just want somebody to answer it before the end of our hearing today, and that is, how did we arrive at this 20,000 limit? And, again, trying to understand the rationale for why this law got put into place in the first place. And also, I'm really disappointed that I don't have a babysitter tonight because all this conversation is really making me want to stop at my favorite place on my way home.
Well, Representative Halverson, I think there are a lot of people here that feel the same way, and I think the bill author can start to answer that, but the real answer is this has been a really long process that's gone on for years, and exactly how we came up with the 20,000 number, I honestly don't remember, but there might be somebody in here, everybody's looking away from me, but there might be somebody that wants to speak to that and how we got to that point. If Mr. Petz, if you want to
take a crack at that one.
Yeah, the numbers, so I was able to participate in both the taproom legislation in 2011 as well as in 2014 when this growler threshold was moved from 3,500 barrels to 20,000 barrels. Going back to 2011, the taproom limit, the 250,000 limit that we're now proposing for growlers as well, came into play because the desire was to make it possible for any of Minnesota's breweries to have that amenity at their location, but with definitely an eye to larger multinational breweries that are from out of state or out of country to prevent them from coming in and doing so. So the very biggest breweries in the world and in the country can't set up shop in Minnesota selling growlers and opening a taproom because they sell in the tens of millions of barrels of beer a year. So that 250,000 barrel limit was comfortably accommodating all Minnesota breweries. The 20,000 barrel threshold, that number was raised from 3,500 to 20,000 in 2014, I believe as a compromise that was struck somewhere between a hearing and the bill passing. And actually, at that time, the original bill that was proposed was 250,000 barrels as well. It just didn't end up there.
Representative Halverson, that's... well, Representative Christensen, do you want this bill to pass? with that, Mr. Petz, thank you very much. And we'll have another testifier, Mr. Where am I here? Mr. Evans Halley from Fair State.
Thank you, committee.
State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you for having me. My name is Evan Salee. I am a board member of the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild, and I am also the president and CEO of Fair State Brewing Cooperative. We're a small consumer cooperatively owned brewery in northeast Minneapolis. We've kind of been straddling a lot of things we're talking about right now. We're incredibly small, focused on our community, but we're growing rapidly. Having just recently announced our expansion into a new, larger production facility in St. Paul. But I'm here to talk about the size of growlers and the size of vessels that we can sell for off-sale. Right now, there's only two sizes that we're allowed to sell to consumers, 500 milliliters and 64 ounces. Our proposal is very limited in scope. We just propose that we rationalize this to make it anything between 500 milliliters and 2 liters. We're not really looking to change the dynamic between the brewer and the retailer here. We're not looking to, adjust the incentives between everybody. What we're just looking to do is to rationalize the law to provide choice to our consumer. Just for example, this is a 64-ounce growler from Dangerous Man. This is a 2-liter growler brought in by many consumers into our brewery. We get a number of consumers coming into our brewery every week with growlers similar to this one who are looking to get it filled. You can get these at breweries across state lines in Iowa and Wisconsin. You can also get them down at your local homebrew store. It is only 3.6 ounces in difference, and yet we're not legally allowed to fill this one, and every time a customer comes into our brewery with one of these growlers, we're not able to give them a positive experience. We're also allowed to sell 750 milliliter growlers. That's good. We are not allowed to sell 500 milliliter or 32 ounces. There's no real compelling reason for this restriction to be this small. Moreover, just to the point, the smallest number that we're asking for is 500 milliliters, specifically because it is above 16 ounces, which is a common size for cans, so you're not going to see anything 4-packs of 16-ounce cans in breweries. You're not going to see 6-packs in breweries. We're really just looking to rationalize the law to make sure that it works for the consumer and for the breweries. Right now, it just leads to a lot of consumer confusion, a poor experience, and we're also not able to hit an attractive price point for them. Also, it is relevant to note that 750-milliliter bottles are exceptionally expensive for brewers. As Tom mentioned earlier, that can come up to $2 per bottle for the brewery, just for a 750-milliliter one. Some of the other sizes that we're looking at, if we were allowed to fill in them, we could drop that cost to the brewer to 50 cents, thereby allowing us to pass that savings on to the consumer, allowing brewers just more flexibility and the ability to provide a better price and a better service to their consumers. I think I have pretty much covered everything.
Thank you, Mr. Salee. Members, any questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, just this thought occurred to me when we were having the testimony by the current testifier. I don't know if there's an answer. I don't know if I'm directing it to anyone in particular, but if there was an upper limit cap on how many barrels per year you could sell, why would we look at putting a restriction on the size and quantity that you could purchase? Once you run out, you run out. Why? What was our rationale behind 64 ounces and 500 milliliters and some of those? I mean, when you follow the different containers up here, when you hit your limit, you hit your limit.
That, like Representative Halverson's question earlier, I think it's a long and somewhat tortured answer. And we can, there might be somebody that wants to come down and take a crack at that. I'm not seeing anybody. Well, Representative O'Driscoll, we'll do a little research and get into that, but there's a long list of that. I think the main reason that people came out with 64 ounces is because that's what everybody else was doing for a growler.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know if it necessarily warrants a lot of discussion. The thought just occurs to me, there's an upper limit. Why would we talk about the vessel or the container size as long as it's within reason? I mean, you don't back up your milk truck and load up and head home, I suspect, but the idea being that.
Yeah, I think Representative O'Driscoll and members, I think that the idea was that we all want to keep the integrity of the three-tier system, and it's worked for a long time, and all of this is something new. And in an effort to try to figure out a way to make it work, starting without or right at the edge and then getting into the three-tier system, I think that the growler size was picked because bars and restaurants and liquor stores weren't doing it, and I think it's kind of a traditional, other states were doing that 64-ounce. And I don't see anybody in the crowd that's really vigorously shaking their head, so maybe that's sort of close to why it happened that way. With that, Mr. Saleh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then we have the Miss Jennifer Schoenzeit from Zips Liquors. Ms. Schoenzeit, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jennifer Schoenzeit. I am the owner of Zips Liquor Store in South Minneapolis by Augsburg. We are a small family-run business. My parents started it. Now my brother and I run it. I'm also the president of the Minnesota Liquor and Beverage Association. At Zips, we sell products, but one of our specialties, a reason people drive to our store from across the city, across the state, and across the country, is for what we are, the largest craft beer store in Minnesota. We sell about 36 Minnesota breweries, about 218 SKUs, 18 Minnesota cideries, and about 37 SKUs. We sell about 1,500 different beers in our store. As you consider changing the laws, I wanted to remind you that the entire liquor industry in the state of Minnesota worked to survive based on existing laws. Some are good and helpful, and others help businesses, and some are hurtful. You seem content to change individual laws without looking at the big picture. Yesterday, the House voted in favor to Sunday sales, a law that supported bigger stores, including the based out of state, and hurt small businesses that have been paying taxes and supporting our communities here in Minnesota for many years. Today, I'm here to oppose HF1078 to again fight for the survival of my business. While I have to choose between staffing my store on Sundays or sacrificing sales to other stores, we are now talking about allowing the four largest breweries in the state to compete directly with me by selling directly to the consumer. I believe the current system works regarding small breweries, and the current laws are not slowing down the birth and development of breweries in Minnesota. Some facts. First, in 2011, there were 35 breweries in operation in the state. Since then, the numbers have tripled to over 120. Seems like the growth is occurring. Second, in Minnesota, only three breweries have closed in the last 5 years, a success rate of 95.7%, and this is a success rate that almost doubles that of almost any other new business. HF-178 focuses on the sales of growlers by breweries to the customers. For off-sale consumption, it focuses on how the growler sizes, quantities to be allowed, and the size of breweries that should be allowed to sell them. From my perspective, this bill allows every brewery in the state, no matter how big, to become a liquor store, to sell directly to the customer. It would allow every brewery to completely compete directly with liquor stores taking away our customers and limiting the needs for customers to come into my store. In the past, brewers argued they needed to sell growlers to have revenue to help them get up and run and to make a mark and make it a brand. Traditionally, Minnesota retailers, bars, liquor stores have always been concerned that allowing breweries to sell directly to customers would create an unfair playing field, giving breweries a huge advantage over traditional retail channels. A brewer needs only to move a keg from one side of the room to the other to sell a product to the customer, whereas a bar or liquor store has to pay additional costs paying the brewery for the product up front, get it into the store or bar, and then even sell it to the customers. If breweries can function as retailers in direct competition with bars and liquor stores, they will have an unfair advantage. In current law, the growler size is unique. It is large, it's a niche product that doesn't directly compete with liquor stores offering, which are traditionally smaller in size. We support the current size. It has been proven to be accepted in the marketplace and has given the brewers the chance to market and promote their products and help them succeed, thrive, and grow exponentially, I might add. Allowing breweries to sell smaller sizes would allow them to compete directly with every liquor store in the state and effectively become liquor stores themselves, but without any regards traditional liquor stores are held to, and given the unfair advantage in the marketplace while hurting the liquor stores in Minnesota. When growlers were first allowed, they were only looked to breweries to make fewer than 3,500 barrels a year. That was a benefit to help small breweries market, produce, grow, and grow their brands and grow revenue to help them survive and succeed. 4 years later, Fulton Liquid Breweries approached the 3,500 mark barrel. They sought to increase the limits because they felt extra revenue was important to help them grow. At the time, the annual production cap increased from 3,500 to 20,000 barrels, almost six times the previous allowed. As proposed, this raises the cap now to 250,000 barrels, more than 12 times the current limit. That's 71 times the level it was just 4 years ago. At some point, we need to realize that there's no longer small breweries needing to break to survive, and instead are businesses trying to grab share from traditional retail channels, the bars and liquor stores that have supported their brands in the liquor industry in the state of Minnesota for many years. There's four or five breweries in the state that produce more than 20,000 barrels, Summit, Shells, Third Street, Surly. Summit and Shells are about 130,000 to 150,000 barrels. Surly's about 70,000, and as we heard, Fulton's around 27. And as these breweries, Fulton now is getting close, is asking for the laws to change again. In addition to removing the cap in the number of barrels a brewery can sell, growler form current limit is 500 barrels a year. It's clearly an attempt to allow breweries to become liquor stores and compete directly with every liquor store in the state. If a cap is increased, breweries would never have to sell product to the liquor stores or bars. They could compete directly with the customers and limit distribution of their products to their own breweries. If Summit, Shells, Surly, and a few other breweries had the ability to sell as much out the front door of their buildings in any size container they wanted, they would have the market potential to destroy all liquor stores that are nearby. Why would you come to my store when you're at the brewery and you can buy the same product, probably for less than what I'm selling it for? For these reasons, I and every other liquor store owner I know of are opposed to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schoenzeit. Members, any questions? Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is directed to our liquor store owner. Just wanted to know, and if this was covered before, I apologize. When you determine what beer you're going to offer in your facility, do you just decide you want to offer something and call them up and order that?
Ms. Schoenzeit.
It's very different from product to product. Most of the small breweries are approaching us to sell their products because they know that we have the clientele they want to go to them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Halverson? Oh, Representative Barr.
So you mentioned a couple of large breweries, and I'll show my beer ignorance, but Surly, Summit, and Shells. And if I'm wondering if you could tell me, do you offer those for sale in your facility?
Ms. Schoenzeit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we do.
Okay. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then of the smaller breweries that testified today, and I apologize if I don't get the names, the two that I remember were Dangerous Man and Fulton, I believe. Do you offer those in your facility?
Mr. Chair, Dangerous Man does not sell to liquor stores. My customers want their product, but they're selling it out their front door versus us being their distributing chain.
And
Fulton, Representative Barr.
The other one?
Yes.
Fulton, you do sell it?
Yes.
Okay, so...
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for some of these products, there's no other means of distribution.
I'm not involved.
Representative Barr, I think the only brewery that self-distributes like Dangerous Man is Dangerous Man, as far as I know. Ms. Schoenzeit, that you can...
There are others that are below the limit that are still self-distributing, correct.
But they would like, and I don't mean to speak to them, but my assumption is they would like to get to the point where they're in your liquor store.
That is our hope.
I think that's pretty safe hope. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment. Thanks for the testimony. It's very clear that we are dealing with making sure that many different small businesses in the liquor industry get to compete and get to be successful. And we don't want to get in the way of anybody's success. So it's good to hear your point of view. I certainly have heard from a lot of small business owners who are working for distributors or for liquor stores at this point who have a lot of concerns about this. So it was helpful to hear that point of view. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Ms. Schoenzeit, I would agree. It was interesting. Good testimony. Thank you. Seeing no other member questions right now, one last testifier will be done. Mr. Brant Irwin, and then as usual, we're going to have Mr. Inoso come down and back clean up for his brevity. He gives me the thumbs up. Mr. Irwin, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commerce Committee. My name is Brant Irwin. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Madigan, Dahl & Harlan. I did attempt to strike some portions of my testimony while I was waiting to try and keep this brief for you. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Madigan, Dahl & Harlan. We are legal counsel to the Minnesota Beer Wholesalers Association. We're the trade association of family-owned distributors that employ thousands of Minnesotans throughout the state, and there are several of our members here today. I'm here to provide testimony on behalf of MBWA in opposition to House File 1078, a bill that would dramatically upset the current level playing field that exists in the industry. This bill would provide manufacturers a substantial competitive advantage not available to the thousands of family-owned distributors and retailers who have invested in the current regulatory system and operated responsibly in the state for decades. Under current law, Minnesota brewers already enjoy regulatory exemptions which provide them with substantial competitive advantages. Specifically, a brewery manufacturing 20,000 barrels of beer per year, which is the equivalent of 260,000 cases, is permitted to sell 500 barrels of beer per year, which is the equivalent of over 6,500 cases. They can sell these to consumers for off-premise consumption. Sales of those 500 barrels per year are currently limited to, as you've seen, 64-ounce growlers or 750-milliliter bottles. The proposed legislation eviscerates those regulations by increasing the current production limit of 20,000 barrels to 250,000 barrels. It eliminates the 500-barrel limit, and it redefines the containers in which such products may be sold. To put this into perspective, 250,000 barrels per year represents over 3.25 million cases and encompasses 98% of all brewers in the country. The current law was created to nurture new breweries, but a brewer producing over 250,000 cases per year does not need a regulatory exemption which confers a substantial competitive advantage over thousands of other industry members. Our current regulatory system is designed to prevent the vertical integration of this socially sensitive industry. Specifically, under the three-tiered system, each tier is restricted to its service function. Brewers brew and sell to distributors. Distributors distribute and sell to retailers. Retailers then have the right to sell to consumers. Through this regulatory system of checks and balances, global manufacturing conglomerates cannot monopolize the industry by acquiring distribution and retail outlets. This system has provided substantial benefits to the citizens of both Minnesota and the United States. First, the industry remains one of the last bastions of family-owned businesses in the state. Local distributors and retailers are rooted in the communities in which they sell, and as a result, they encounter their consumers daily within the community and accordingly sell their products responsibly. These stable businesses are a mainstay of their host communities. They employ tens of thousands of Minnesotans and serve as a critical source of philanthropic support. Secondly, because retailers are not owned by suppliers, they offer consumers unprecedented choice and variety from thousands of suppliers. Contrast that, for instance, with the soft drink industry, which lacks such regulation and is dominated by just two suppliers, Coke and Pepsi. Finally, because distributors serve as a buffer between suppliers and retailers, retailers are insulated from the pressure to overpromote and oversell alcohol, which would inevitably result from supplier ownership. This bill would effectively collapse the three-tiered system and confer an unfair and unnecessary competitive advantage on just a few businesses. There are over 10,000 distributors and retailers who have invested their life savings in the current regulatory system, and this system has served the industry and the consuming public very well, creating an efficient, fair, balanced, and transparent market for alcoholic beverages. It's difficult to understand exactly why a very limited group is being provided with additional advantages not available to other industry members. It's not justified by job creation because the majority of jobs will not be created, but will merely be displaced jobs of surrounding retailers that are not provided the same competitive advantages. It's not justified by assisting what was once viewed as small business, since the extreme increase in capacity limits will open the door to literally all Minnesota breweries selling at retail. A production brewery that can produce 250,000 barrels of malt beverages per year is not a small brewery. That requires a competitive advantage to get their foot in the door. As I stated earlier, 250,000 barrels is the equivalent of 3.25 million cases. There are no Minnesota breweries producing anywhere near that amount of product. To put the number into context, in 2016, the top two breweries in the state of Minnesota shipped 135,000 and 128,000 barrels, respectively. As a side note, this proposed bill also exposes the state to a constitutional challenge. The legislation opens the door to a potential dormant commerce clause challenge, since the law would, in essence, discriminate in purpose and effect between an in-state brewer who can sell directly to consumers and, given the increased production limits, would literally include every Minnesota brewery and out-of-state brewers who cannot sell directly to Minnesota consumers. The proposed bill would significantly alter the current regulatory system in Minnesota and have a detrimental impact on distributors, retailers, and consumers. It provides exemptions and exceptions to the three-tiered system and legislatively creates an unfair competitive advantage to a very small group of businesses. We oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Irwin. Mr. Reynoso? Welcome back to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be very brief, and I kind of want to just put some realistic numbers, some real numbers to what we're talking about here. You know, moving from 20,000 barrels, 20,000 barrels of beer. And let me preface by saying, hey, Teamsters love beer. It's not that we don't like beer, and as a matter of fact, I'm a big fan of it. 20,000 barrels of beer amounts to 79,360,000 ounces of beer. It comes up to about 4,960,000 16-ounce pours. That's not enough. So what this bill is proposing, and let me say this also, 500 barrels of beer amount to 30,000 growlers, and that's not enough. We got to eliminate it. We want to sell more than 30,000 growlers. But we're not trying to circumvent the three-tier system, guys. Moving it to 250,000 barrels of beer amounts to 992 million 16-ounce pours. We're not talking small change here. That's a lot of beer. So to move from 20,000 to 250,000, they're still coming in here with a straight face saying they don't want to circumvent the three-tier system. That's nonsense. This is a clear way for them to, for these small, so-called small brewers. You heard one of the testifiers say they don't want to grow. They like being where they're at. And I've been to, I believe it was Fulton that she testified from. I like some of their beers. But if they want to stay small, how could you say they want to stay small, but they need a ceiling of 250,000 barrels of beer? Or better yet, 30,000 growlers isn't enough. But we believe in the three-tier system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reynoso. Members, thank you for a good discussion. Everybody in the audience that testified for and against the various bills. With that, Representative Christensen will give you the final word on this bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll be very brief. I think my testifiers made a very convincing case for the bill. As small business owners and people creating jobs in their community and jobs in our state. So I'm looking forward to continuing the discussion and working for a solution that works for everybody.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. And with that, House File 1078 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus liquor bill. Members, thank you for your time. We are adjourned.